Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The investment is going to really improve the quality of life on Prince of Wales Island and give people new opportunities and hope for the future.
Federal funding is set to boost internet access in rural Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, without the state's Ocean Rangers program, Glacier Bay National Park turns to independent inspectors.
We would not have an inspection program if the Ocean Ranger program didn't exist.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
A bipartisan group of U.S. senators that includes Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski released legislation today that would codify Roe v. Wade. That's according to reporting by the Alaska Beacon. The bill would ensure that pregnant patients throughout the country would once again have the right to an abortion. Murkowski joined Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins, Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, and Arizona Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema in sponsoring the measure called the Reproductive Freedom for All Act, which they say would protect access to abortion and contraception. The bill is a response to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in June in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which overturned a 1973 decision that established abortion as a constitutional right. Murkowski said in a written statement announcing the bill that, quote, for 5 decades, reproductive health care decisions were centered with the individual. We cannot go back in time in limiting personal freedoms for women, end quote. The proposal would prevent state governments from limiting abortion access before viability, often 22 to 24 weeks into a pregnancy, similar to what the law was before the Dobbs decision. It would allow state governments to limit or ban abortions after that point as long as there's an exception for the pregnant patient's life or health. The bipartisan bill would likely elicit a stronger floor vote than an abortion rights bill Senate Democrats brought to the floor in May, though it's unlikely to get the 60 votes needed to move past that chamber's legislative filibuster. Yep, it's August 1st, and that means that early and absentee in-person voting are open for Alaska's August 16th elections. And voting for both the regular primary election and the special general election will be on the same ballot. In the Pick 1 primary election, voters will choose their top pick for U.S. Senator, U.S. Representative, Governor, State Senator, and State Representative. The top 4 vote-getters in each race will go on to the November general election ballot. The back of the ballot will have ranked choice voting for the special election to decide who will fill the rest of the term left by the late Representative Don Young. Voters will rank 3 candidates, Republicans Sarah Palin and Nick Begich and Democrat Mary Peltola, who were determined by a Pick 1 primary in June. Early in-person voting is available in Juneau, Anchorage, Eagle River, Fairbanks, Palmer, Soldotna, Homer, and Nome. After redistricting, some polling places have changed. The state's Division of Elections mailed new voter registration cards to all Alaska voters in mid-July with their polling place listed. If voting in person, bring a government-issued ID, which can be a voter ID card or a valid ID with a photo on it, like a driver's license, passport, military ID, or hunting or fishing license. Voters can also request a ballot by mail, online, or by fax. The deadline to request a mail-in ballot is Saturday. For more information about the elections, to find your polling place, or to see sample ballots, go to elections.alaska.gov. Well, Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve started its own cruise ship monitoring program this July. Cruise companies are paying for independent inspectors to board ships unannounced and make sure they follow environmental rules. KTOO's Claire Strempel reports.
Glacier Bay used to rely on the state's Ocean Ranger program for these inspections, but the program was defunded before the pandemic.
We were really hopeful that the Ocean Ranger program would continue.
Park scientist Scott Gendy said the Ocean Rangers were essential to the park's tourism structure.
We would not have an inspection program if the Ocean Ranger program didn't exist.
Ocean Rangers made sure the large cruise ships followed environmental rules, especially around the kind of wastewater they can discharge into Alaska waters. It was started by voters and paid for it through a statewide tax on cruise ship passengers. Governor Mike Dunleavy defunded the program in 2019. It's still on the books, but it hasn't been in the budget since. That puts the park and the cruise companies in a tight spot because they signed a decade-long contract that legally commits them to inspections. Park Superintendent Philip Hoogie says that those contracts mean the park has some of the highest environmental standards in the world.
We work tightly in partnership, a really good relationship with the cruise industry, but we also need to have independent verification on all aspects of our contract.
The park covers 3.3 million acres, and it's considered one of the gems of Southeast Alaska. Coastal temperate rainforest is punctuated by deep glacier-carved fjords and snow-covered peaks. About 600,000 people visit the park by cruise ship each year. The National Park Service's duty is to protect these resources while still making them available to the American public. The state still does port inspections on cruise ships, but Gendy says they don't go far enough. The park needs inspectors that are on the ships while they're at sail and who arrive unannounced for random inspections. Gendy says he hopes the independent contractor is a temporary solution.
We'd be thrilled to death if the state would integrate that into their Ocean Ranger program, and we can get some Ocean Rangers back on board. But until then, this is our approach, and we're going to continue forward with these third-party inspectors.
So far, three major cruise lines have signed a contract with third-party inspectors. The park expects a contract with the fourth large cruise company soon. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strimple.
More than $100 million in federal funding for rural broadband is heading to Alaska, and about a quarter of the U.S. Department of Agriculture grant money will go towards expanding fiber optic network connections on Prince of Wales Island. KRBD's Reagan Miller reports.
Affordable, high-speed internet is closer to becoming a reality for more than 1,200 residents on Prince of Wales Island. That's because of a $29.3 million grant that was awarded to Alaska Power and Telephone by the USDA ReConnect program. The Alaska Telecom Company is also kicking in $9 million of its own money. That all funds what AP&T is calling the SeaLink South project. It's a fiber-to-the-premises connection for the communities of Craig, Klawock, and Hollis. It'll provide high-speed internet connections of at least 100 megabits per second. AP&T Vice President Jason Custer says the fiber optic network will be a big upgrade.
These are definitely underserved locations, and we provide the best service that we're able to, but that depends upon the strength of the infrastructure in the communities and also the backhaul infrastructure out of the communities.
He says the grant could put the areas on par with urban communities.
The investment is going to really improve the quality of life on Prince of Wales Island and give people new opportunities and hope for the future.
SeaLink South will bring fiber optic networks to an estimated 1,236 residents, 45 businesses, and a school in Craig, Klawock, and Hollis. Construction is expected to start between 2024 and 2027. AP&T plans to enroll in both the Federal Communications Commission's Lifeline program and the Affordable Connectivity program. Both target low-income customers and provide adjusted monthly rates and discounts to low-income households. Prince of Wales Island wasn't the only area in Alaska to benefit from a fiber optic grant. The USDA program also awarded $34 million to the Bristol Bay Telephone Cooperative, $31 million to the Bethel Area Unicom Company, and $21 million to the Cordova Telephone Corporation. All told, the federal grants are estimated to connect more than 5,400 Alaskans to high-speed broadband. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage Assembly now has a process to remove a mayor for a breach of public trust.
This ordinance is not intended to be implemented. It is intended to be on the books should the need arise.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
The Anchorage Assembly has overridden Mayor Dave Bronson's veto of an ordinance that gives the Assembly a process to remove a mayor for a breach of public trust. The Assembly voted to override the mayor's veto 9-3 at a brief meeting this afternoon. Member Chris Constant, who represents North Anchorage, authored the ordinance and says it's intended to be used for extreme abuses of power by a mayor.
A pattern of behavior that rises to the level of abuse that regular people would look and ask, how could this person do such a thing? That it's unconscionable that that action should have taken place.
Under the ordinance, there are a dozen offenses that would constitute a breach of public trust, including perjury, asking a municipal employee to break the law, and falsifying records. The new ordinance does not get rid of the ability for citizens to organize a recall. It just adds another avenue for a mayor to be removed. Constant says it creates a set of clear boundaries for what is and what is not acceptable by a mayor.
This ordinance is not intended to be implemented. It is intended to be on the books should the need arise.
The Assembly initially approved the ordinance last month after weeks of debate across multiple meetings. Bronson called the measure a partisan attack and vetoed it several days later. Assembly members Jamie Allard, Randy Sult, and Kevin Cross voted against the override. Cross, who represents Eagle River, says he thinks it gives the Assembly too much power in deciding who is the mayor.
I see a direct conflict of interest that the people who remove them are the people who can stick their own person in there.
In a statement after his veto was overridden, Bronson said the ordinance would create public distrust and discord and will, quote, set a precedent that will forever change how municipal government is administered. A team of researchers have been spending part of the summer at a Kodiak Island base studying the effects of climate change. KMXD's Kirsten Dobroth reports it's part of a community monitoring project that could hold bigger clues for the future of fisheries in the Gulf of Alaska.
Joellen Lotzfeldt spends part of her time at a cabin she owns on Larsen Island in Kodiak's Anton Larsen Bay, less than a mile skiff ride from the boat launch. Deer and Kodiak brown bears frequent the shoreline of Anton Larsen Bay, and sea otters and loons float on the water's surface. Lotzfeldt is a marine ecosystem researcher, and she says under the water, there's a thriving ecosystem, too.
The bay has lots of great eelgrass and kelp beds, which is of particular importance to young fish that have hatched and are spending that first summer somewhere before they'll leave.
Of particular interest to Lotzfeldt are the tiny species that you can't see, zooplankton. Those are the microscopic organisms that drift in bodies of freshwater and saltier bays like Anton Larsen. She's been monitoring zooplankton at sites around the bay since 2017.
I'm doing work and research in what I call the near shore zone, which is really kind of where the freshwater comes down, meets the ocean, all the way out to where the continental shelf drops off. That interplay of organisms is humans down to the little teeny phytoplankton. And it all matters.
Lotzfeldt says one of the biggest concerns she heard from her neighbors when she'd tell them about her research were questions about where fish once common to Anton Larsen Bay, like Pacific cod, had gone. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is also trying to answer that question. The organization's draft Regional Climate Action Plan for the Gulf of Alaska outlines studying the effects of marine heat waves on juvenile Pacific cod as one of its recommendations. Increased research on zooplankton is also part of the plan's proposal. This year, Lotzfeldt received funding from Alaska Sea Grant to expand her monitoring project and welcomed a team of researchers to her property on Larsen Island in mid-July.
It's on the road system, so there's some logistics, the reason that Anton is selected.
Ben Laurel is a research fisheries biologist with NOAA's Alaska Fisheries Science Center. He was part of the team that traveled to Larsen Island earlier this summer to study Pacific cod. He says that site monitoring, like what's being done on Anton Larsen Bay, could hold bigger clues for the rest of the Gulf. And it's critically important as research budgets and seasonal temperatures tend to fluctuate.
We need to have these sorts of partnerships established and information sort of exchanged between groups so they can kind of benefit from one another.
An invaluable part of that information exchange comes from people who live on Anton Larsen Bay and fishermen from Kodiak who are on the front lines of climate change, according to Laurel.
We've been doing this for 17 years, but, you know, there's people out there for more than 30, 40 years that have seen even, you know, more dramatic changes.
Connecting locals living on the bay and researchers was a big part of this last trip to Larsen Island, according to Lotsfeldt. She says that connection is crucial as climate change accelerates ocean variability. And she's hoping to expand the annual gathering to include more members of the community in years to come.
Having information from people who live on the sea or live on the coast, who are out there all the time, that information is valuable. It may not be a perfectly designed, statistically valid study, but it's really good information.
Lotsfeldt says it's too early to tell whether this summer's samples from Anton Larsen Bay point to broader trends in the Gulf of Alaska, but it's just a starting point she hopes to build on in the coming years. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
A group from the Lower 48 plans to share an indigenous art form and advocate for physical, spiritual, and cultural healing in Alaska. The effort is called the Jingle Dress Project. As KNBA's Trip J. Krause reports, the group hopes a trip to Alaska is the first of many.
That's the sound of jingle dress dancing. The art form began in the Lower 48 about 100 years ago and spread throughout indigenous communities. One of the dancers for the Jingle Dress Project, Dion Tapahi, talks about the importance of the dance.
And it's significant because when you do dance, the jingle dress dance, it sounds either like rain. They represent prayers going up to the creator. And so it's a dress of healing. And when you do the dance, it's a dance of prayer and of healing.
This dancing is usually seen and heard at competitions during powwows and forums of creative expression. Cultural Understanding says during the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, an Ojibwe man first dreamt of the jingle dress as a way to heal his sick daughter. In 2020, during the COVID-19 pandemic, many of the art shows that Diné photographer Eugene Tapahi participated in began to cancel. The virus also started to impact the people around him. He says a dream inspired him to begin the Jingle Dress Project. After he told his family about the dream, he recruited daughters Dion and Erin Tapahi, as well as Sunny and Joanie Begay. They've traveled thousands of miles to speak to communities about the project. The goal of the project is to travel and give hope through art, dance, and culture to help us heal. The group plans their first trip to Alaska for August 4th through the 11th. They will visit Ketchikan and the surrounding area. Eugene Tapahi says they plan to talk to elders, students, and the community as a whole.
We have a pretty tight schedule when we're there. We'll be there for 7 days. And I think that's the part that we really are excited about, is that because COVID's a little bit better now, and we can have this time to be able to go into the communities to share our message and our culture. And also, like Sunny said, we're excited to be able to learn from them and to try and open up some connections to be able to help one another. In we all have different issues that we're dealing with, but most of the time it's usually the same issue that we're dealing with, but just different lands and different areas. And so we're hoping that we could be a resource to be able to help those out there also.
The group says logistics of traveling in Alaska limited this trip to the Ketchikan area. But Erin Tapahi says they want to return and visit more places.
Yeah. Well, I think we were wanting to go to Sitka and a couple other places. But when we're trying to, in the planning portion, we didn't quite realize how big Alaska was. So we can't quite go to all the places that we hoped for in one trip.
In 2021, Erin completed the Boston Marathon and performed a jingle dress dance for the runners and those impacted by COVID-19.
And so being able to bring the jingle dress into everyday life kind of that way has been important, because it's been important for me to try and keep myself in a positive way, doing, keeping myself healthy and having positive thoughts and trying to refrain from negativity in my life. And so I think that's been a big part of getting back into regularly dancing.
During the group's visit, they'll also participate in the Blueberry Arts Festival and will give a presentation at the Tongass Historical Museum. In Anchorage, I'm Trip Krause.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The Kenai Peninsula Food Bank is fundraising for its fuel budget. This year, after dealing with exceptionally high gas prices, the food bank burned through its entire fuel budget for the year by the summer. The food bank uses diesel fuel to power its large delivery trucks. Diesel is currently averaging around $6 a gallon in Alaska. The food bank works with more than 70 partner agencies around the peninsula to get food out to communities from Homer to Hope.
We're pretty deep in the hole for fuel, but it's one of our essential things. We have to be able to deliver out to those places, otherwise people go hungry.
Lily Murray is the coordinator for the fundraiser. She says so far the food bank has dealt with the fuel deficit by using funds from other parts of the budget, but this is creating shortages in other areas. The food bank is seeking contracts with fuel distributors on the peninsula to get discounts on fuel. For now, it will continue to draw on any funds it has. The food bank has launched a fundraising page on its website where people can donate at kpfoodbank.org. After no commercial crabbing since 2019, this summer's Norton Sound Red King crab fishery had a record ex-vessel value of $3.7 million. According to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the 2022 commercial season had the region's best harvest since 2017. And when adjusted for inflation, Fish and Game says this season's ex-vessel value reached levels that haven't been seen since the late 1970s and early 80s. One contributing factor was the record price of $12 per pound paid by Norton Sound Seafood Products. NOAA issued a disaster declaration for the 2019 season because of poor commercial crabbing conditions. This season's total harvest was over 290,000 pounds. Well, reality TV stars from the long-running Discovery series Alaska Bush People made a brief stop in Petersburg earlier this month. The famous Brown family tried to buy land after living in Washington the last 3 years. But as Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, locals did not welcome them as neighbors.
Petersburg South Harbor is home to many large commercial fishing boats. One of them is the Norseman, owned by Mark Hofstad. He can be found there most days he's not fishing. In early July, Hofstad noticed the Alaska Bush People's boat on the same float and staff from the show's production company walking around. So he started bugging the harbor master to move them someplace else.
It's because I don't want to look at them.
On one of Hofstad's visits to the harbor office, a Brown family member also showed up.
That one kid, I think they call him Gabe, introduced himself and stuck out his hand. I looked down. I ain't shaking your hand. He just looked at me and walked away.
Hofstad is clearly not a fan of the series. The show follows the Brown family through 13 seasons as they attempt to live off the land in Alaska.
After 34 years in the wilderness of Alaska, Billy Brown and his family are committing to the bush like never before.
But they haven't always been residents. That clip was from 2016 after six family members were charged with 60 counts of PFD fraud for receiving nearly $21,000 in payments when they didn't qualify. Patriarch Billy Brown, who died last year, and one of his sons pleaded guilty and were sentenced to 30 days in jail, fined, and ordered to do community service. They were also banned from applying for PFDs in the future. The deal dropped the cases against the other family members, but they still had to pay back the dividends. Hofstad calls them liars.
I mean, look what the show is. It's non-residents portraying themselves as Alaskans that basically make us all look like a bunch of frickin' morons.
Emily Fehrenbacher knows not all Alaskans like the series. She herself had been an avid follower. For 5 years, she wrote a column for the Anchorage Daily News about reality TV in the state. She says Alaska Bush People draws a following down south.
Really, it's like a lot of Alaska reality shows where they're playing up just like the remoteness and kind of building drama around the typical Alaskan lifestyle.
But the Browns push it a little further, from reality. And Fehrenbacher understands why it rubs some Alaskans the wrong way.
It just seemed like a lot of it was pretty staged for television.
The show's production company, Park Slope Productions, nor the Discovery Channel responded to requests for comment for the story. Disgust for the Browns and their show is a popular sentiment among Petersburg residents. Local realtor George Doyle was contacted by the production company, but says he didn't engage.
We were approached, but I didn't respond to them because, again, we weren't interested in having that type of activity.
Doyle says again because this wasn't the first time. About a decade ago, the show was looking for a plot across Frederick Sound on the mainland in a place called Point Agassiz.
The folks at Agassiz weren't necessarily excited in seeing the camera crew and everybody move in there.
The Brown family has lived in different communities in Alaska over the years and has burned some bridges along the way. About a decade ago, they were at Mosquito Lake, 30 miles north of Haines on the highway. Jim Stanford was a neighbor and says they seemed like con men.
They certainly weren't living off the land, you know, building their own cabin and stuff like that. You could tell they were more users than givers. Not really the kind of people that you would want as a direct neighbor.
He says he doesn't wish the Brown family ill will, but they didn't fit in with his community where folks helped each other.
Depending on the neighbors for support and everybody pitching in, the Browns weren't cut of that cloth.
Hofstad, Doyle, and others in Petersburg say they're not against all Alaska reality TV. For example, the National Geographic show Port Protection, which is based out of Prince of Wales Island, is a local favorite. Hofstad says it's not fake.
You know, I know some of the people in the show and, you know, it depicts life.
The Alaska Bush People show was unsuccessful in buying land near Petersburg. Another local realtor did show them a piece of property near town, but they didn't want it. So when their boat left Petersburg's harbor July 15th, Hofstad was relieved.
Keep going, man. Just keep going.
Where they're headed and whether or not there will be a 14th season in Alaska is unknown. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Sage Smiley in Wrangell, Claire Strempel in Juneau, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Wesley Early and Trip Krause in Anchorage, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, Riley Board in Kenai, Davis Hovey in Nome, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline since 1977, from Prudhoe Bay to the Port of Valdez.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.